Well, this is one White House press conference that ought to be worth coming for.
Yeah, do you think it means war?
What do you think, Captain Eddie?
Well, of course, it's anybody's guess, but I bet it.
Gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good day, gentlemen. Any questions?
Mr. President, you know what's on our minds today.
Yes, it's on all our minds. And I have a statement for you. We have reason to believe, good reason to believe, that the British steamship Ophelia, with American citizens aboard, was torpedoed 2 days off the coast of Ireland by Nazi Germany.
Broadcasting Company presents Tales of the Foreign Service, a series in NBC's University of the Air, written and produced in cooperation with the State Department and dedicated to the personnel of the Foreign Service. The material used in this series is based upon the confidential files of the State Department, much of it never before released to the public.
Tonight's program might be called The Sinking of the Athenia, but it's a bigger story than that. It is the exciting drama and intrigue that lay behind one first important press release issued on September 8, 1939, from the highest authority in this nation, the White House. September 3rd, 1939. The place, the British liner Athenia, 48 hours out of sea from Glasgow, Scotland. The situation, passengers returning from a chaotic Europe, caught in a declaration of war between Nazi Germany and the Allies, in an ocean that was in fact far from neutral. Their only hope lay in a safe arrival at their destination, Canada and the United States. Between 7:30 and 7:40 in the evening, during the dinner hour, when most of the passengers were in the dining salon without their life preservers, a young divinity student, Donald Edwards, of Lakewood, Ohio, was making his way to his stateroom.
As I remember it, I was located so far aft on the starboard side that I was almost over the propeller. I was near my stateroom, starboard on B, just under the topmost deck, when I remember.
Submarine! With the torpedoes! Get on deck! Get to the back boats, everybody!
It's sinking! Help me! Help me!
They're going down! Head-on collision with two heavy bodies. The ship shook all over from the impact. Then, a few seconds later, I'm almost sure of the time. The second crash on the same deck. I had gone forward almost three quarters of the length of the ship. Naturally, we were all terrified. I had a sinking feeling in my stomach. I saw two men ahead of me lying on the deck. The first was unconscious. The other man was struggling for
his feet. Help me!
The second man struggled for a moment and collapsed. His face was covered with blood. They both seemed to be beyond help. I went to find my mother and father.
My wife and I agree with my son, Donald. There were two explosions, but I'm sure each arose from a separate and distinct cause. The first explosion was dull. The second was sharp. There was havoc and flying debris following the second one. I took Mrs. Edwards on deck after the second noise, and she and I
saw a cloud of smoke a little distance off the water, about half a mile, I should think, off the port side. The lights went out after the second one, and as we opened the door of the deck above, we saw flame and smoke, and a billowy cloud of smoke and steam.
Margaret Buchan, a Scots woman from San Francisco, California, saw the black smoke on the water, too, as did others.
I hurried to the lifeboat as I had been instructed after the second explosion. I thought the black smoke was another ship coming to our rescue. I asked the steward who was assisting me, is it a ship? We were the rescue.
That's no ship, Lardy. You better hurry onto that lifeboat. Here, I'll help you.
Thomas Kerr, a naturalized British subject around 70 years old, said afterwards,
I spent all my life as a miner, and I'm well acquainted with all explosives. The sensation of the first explosion was like a blast in a mine. There were two explosions, all right, but they were different. The first was a jar over the entire boat, but the second, a few minutes later, was like the crack of a rifle.
It was a night to remember for all who experienced it. And a night to remember for many aching hearts, keeping an anxious vigil back in America and Canada, waiting for news, for details of the fate of loved ones on board. A great catastrophe often means nothing more to the public than a sensational headline. It is only when disaster touches us personally that we can understand and appreciate fully the chain reaction set off by such an incident, which may eventually not only involve us, but the entire world. But a world disaster must enter our individual world to become real. Then we become aroused.
Whose fault was it?
How did it happen?
Why didn't somebody prevent it?
What happened?
Mine?
Boiler explosion?
Submarine?
Torpedo?
Germany?
This means war.
But could we afford war in September 1939? Think back. There were neutral American citizens involved on a ship whose government was already at war. How did this implicate us? Was the Athenia to be another Lusitania? It might have been national suicide to avenge, through a hastily declared war, the misfortunes of a relatively few. But something had to be done. Public opinion insisted on it. When something goes wrong, somebody must be blamed. Who is responsible? Who is the somebody who must take action in such an emergency? The President of the United States? Perhaps. Finally, of course. But the President's representative in such matters is the State Department, not only in Washington, but all over the world in its foreign service. A distress signal. The familiar but always terrifying cry for help in a great emergency went out over the stormy waters to the four corners of the earth. But while confused reports of a disaster were being Morse coded through the air, creating terror in all ocean-going craft, a small American ship, the City of Flint, some knots ahead of the Athenia, received the faint call in the night and turned courageously around to see to her aid. One of the passengers on the City of Flint, young Caleb Davis, an Amherst student, son of the American Consul General at Glasgow, wrote his parents,
Sunday night at about 9:30, we received the SOS. The captain told us to put on our life jackets and go to bed with our clothes on and our passports in our pockets. Searchlights were turned on the flags, and the City of Flint steered toward the Athenia, looking like a Christmas tree playing the Star Spangled Banner. Next morning, we were all up about 5 o'clock and waiting.
Is that the Southern Cross, Caleb?
Yes. Lucky that Swedish yacht happened to be around.
That boat's too small to hold very many of them. Lucky thing our ship is here.
Oh, it sure is. A lifeboat began to come alongside. It was the only remaining Athenia lifeboat. Dirty, half full of water, and very full of very miserable people.
Thank God. What a long night. I'll never forget when we went over the side. Being lowered into the sea. Just like a nightmare. It was a cloudy night, but there was a moon breaking through every now and then. The boat seemed like a great ghost, with the little boat being lowered and gleaming white in the night, and the people standing at the rails above waiting desperately for their turn. Little children, old men, young fellows, girls in their teens, everybody doing what they could. But everybody expecting every minute for the boat to go down. But it didn't that night, miraculously. When we were several yards from the Athenia in the rowboat.
Hey, look at that. Underneath.
We stared in fascination over the side.
It looks like a big fish. Is it a whale, honey?
It wasn't a whale. It wasn't a fish.
Here's the submarine. I saw the periscope before I saw that sub fire on us when I was on deck.
We were sure we'd seen a sub. There was something in the water, gliding under it. Could it come up and fire us on us again? Was it German?
Some there were, of course, who said it was a British incident created to inflame a nation's indignation against the Nazis. But these were perhaps the quick to judge, the ones who, hysterical in crisis, popped to confusion. It was the State Department's obligation to proceed calmly, cautiously, to piece together all the facts and to take the word and opinion of not one, but all, until the difficult mosaic of truth was assembled. But the first task was to look after those immediately in need. The American ship, the City of Flint, together with other vessels, performed unselfishly and gallantly the traditional role of help to a sister ship in distress. Medical supplies arrived from two United States Coast Guard cutters rushed to the scene to escort the City of Flint to Halifax, Nova Scotia. To quote Caleb Davis again,
the foghorn went continually through bad weather, and the nerves of the hysterical survivors were on edge. Another submarine was sighted, but none of the survivors were told of this. The sense of security which the cutters at each side of us gave the survivors is indescribable. At last, we reached Halifax.
We received a royal welcome from planes and 21 gun salutes from all around. At the dock, there was a whole army of reporters, Boy Scouts, Red Cross nurses, and officials.
These officials, whom Caleb Davis mentioned, numbered among them representatives of our Foreign Service in Halifax. The City of Flint delivered its ward into the hands of our American Consul General, 101 American citizens and alien residents of the United States, as well as 25 aliens destined for the United States. The Coast Guard cutters, Bibb and Campbell, had on board 7 survivors removed at sea from the City of Flint for medical attention. For several days, working in conjunction with the Canadian Immigration Authority, the Canadian Red Cross, the Cunard White Star Line officials, and the agent of the City of Flint, the Consulate General had been preparing for reissuance of entry permits and the rendering of such other assistance as would be required, such as funds, identification papers, and such homely comforts as...
You don't know how good these beds look. Thank you. Why, there's even a nursery for the children.
Boys, look at that bathroom. Hot and cold running water.
Look at that food.
You mean we can go ashore immediately?
Yes, but before you do, here's a memorandum which will provide for your comfort here and for restoring you to your home. Now, every possible convenience will be made available to you. We must ask you, however, not to stray too far just now, because we'd appreciate a brief statement from you later on.
First, comfort for the individual and help in restoring his sense of security. Then the long, painstaking process of gleaning such details as were vital to both the individual and to the state of the nation. Meanwhile, although accurate information was being assembled as fast as possible, a frantic and impatient public in the United States was demanding the facts and action, and quick. Letters were being written to congressmen.
What we would like to know, and what thousands of other Texans and tens of thousands of American citizens would like to know, is why has our government taken apparently no interest in the welfare of the approximately 350 American citizens involved in this disaster? Why couldn't our State Department have secured accurate information regarding the disaster and made it available to the thousands of frantic relatives and friends, instead of remaining silent for so many hours while rumors and reports were allowed to go out over the air? Such reports as...
The Athenians reported to have stayed afloat only 30 minutes.
The Athenian was torpedoed and sunk with 1,400. The Athenian ship City of Flint has picked up 8 survivors of the Athenia, all of them in...
Why did our government send no cruisers or destroyers or planes to the relief of American citizens? Why was nothing done?
Telegrams were pouring into the State Department.
Please advise, collect immediately if so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so were passengers on the Athenia.
Telegrams were going out.
Department records do not indicate your relatives aboard. List includes your wife uninjured. List includes your daughter picked up by SS City of Flint. Information coming to this office reports no such name aboard SS Athenia. Daughter safe in Galway, Ireland. American survivors will be granted precedence in obtaining accommodations for return trip to United States.
Long-distance telephones were ringing.
Was my daughter on board?
Did my son say,
why isn't something being done?
Why isn't something being done?
Thanks to the constant flow of news coming in from foreign service offices at all tactical points involved, Canada, Ireland, England, and Scotland, inquiries were being answered fully and as quickly as possible under communication systems in wartime. Something was being done. Something important to democratic processes of our country. A calm, judicial, clear analysis and investigation was going forward to eliminate hysteria, to eliminate speculation, to establish our country's position in connection with the incident, and at the same time, to ensure comfort, medical attention, sufficient funds, and a safe passage home for the survivors. Regardless of social position, background, or circumstances, these American citizens were receiving their American birthright, fair play, and equal consideration. And the United States, in addition, had its most important detectives on the trail of what had really happened and who was to blame. The international wires were popping. In our embassy in London, Ambassador Kennedy interviewed the Admiralty.
The Admiralty assures the Ambassador that no British mines were laid in the vicinity. The Athenia was torpedoed.
In Dublin, Mr. Cuddy had reported,
it has been established beyond question to reports coming to hand that the vessel was submarine.
On September 7th, Mr. Cuddy telegraphed the State Department in Washington.
My dispatch setting forth my detailed statement should reaffirm beyond question that the Athenia was torpedoed. This conclusion verified by Captain Alan Kirk, naval attaché in London, who made independent investigation.
Berlin. The German Foreign Office sent for our chargé d'affaires.
I have read this report from London regarding the sinking of the Athenia. This is too ridiculous. I will inform your government immediately that our German naval authorities declare there are no German warships in that area. And that furthermore, German naval vessels have received strict instructions to treat merchant vessels in accordance with international rules.
Unknown to our ambassador in Germany, the Germans had also summoned a press conference of American correspondents, in which a Nazi interpretation of the report was given.
The sinking never took place. It is a lie.
The Athenia struck a mine.
There was an accident inside the ship.
The ship was sunk by the British themselves to influence American opinion against Germany.
Out of the crossfire of conflicting accusations was emerging some irrefutable evidence. The typewriters of the Foreign Service office staff in Halifax, London, Glasgow, and Dublin were tirelessly recording affidavits from the crews of the rescue ships and in Nassau and the Bahamas, where the yacht Southern Cross had put in.
My name is Carl Herdorf. I am master of the yacht Southern Cross. I arrived at the scene of the sinking on Monday, September 4th, 1939, about 2:30 a.m. The sinking was caused by a torpedo or a time bomb. The ship at daybreak was flying with her stern down, with a port side list. I saw it sink at 10 a.m., stern up, without any other explosion.
The chief engineer of the Southern Cross.
There is a lot of fuel in the water. It couldn't have been a boiler explosion. When a boiler explodes, the roar of steam is distinctly heard. No one reported it.
Another report.
My name is Chalmers Rothman. I am chief officer of the yacht Southern Cross. We none of us knew the cause of the sinking of the Athenia. When she sank, she was 4 nautical miles away from us. from observation, there must have been a terrific explosion to blow so big a hole in the Athena.
My name is Thor Nielsen, second officer. It was caused by a torpedo. There could not have been an anchor's mine in that depth of water and so far of sea.
This is the story in perspective by impersonal eyewitnesses. This was then relentlessly backed up by statement after statement of the survivors. These accounts, as the foreign officers well knew, might be colored by prejudice, memory blurred through shock, or even the desire to claim the limelight. But so far as possible, every man had his voice.
My job was quartermaster on the Athenian. I was on watch at the time. A submarine conning tower broke surface about 800 yards in the port quarter, and a gun or explosive signal was fired from the conning tower platform.
Another eyewitness report.
As the submarine was on the weather side of the Athenia, the smoke from this discharge blew down over the ship, and a strong smell of cordite was recognized.
William Laidlaw was interviewed in the hospital at Galway.
There were two explosions. I fell into the water after the lifeboat had been lowered and they brought me here. They tell me I am suffering from exposure.
A German refugee, Miss Ruth Strauss, gave a very clear account of the whole affair.
I remember distinctly the splash over the water on the port side and the black smoke.
Others.
The Athenia was struck without warning by an undersurface projectile.
The ship was fired on twice. The second projectile came through the air of the water from the port side at a distance of 800 to 1,000 yards.
Charles Van Newkirk, mechanical engineer.
In my opinion, the attack was made by a torpedo, without warning.
Robert Pierce Casey, professor at Brown University.
That is my definite opinion. The shot was fired by the submarine.
Mrs. Kate Ellen Hines.
I detected a heavy odor like burning gunpowder.
Mrs. Doris McCloud.
I saw at some distance from the ship a flash of flame surrounded by smoke.
Statement after statement after statement confirmed the fact. The explosion, periscope, and the unmistakable smell of gunpowder. But while the State Department, through its foreign staff, was finishing its job of criminal investigator and reporter, it had not brought the last American home. It was comparatively easy to handle the situation in Halifax, Nova Scotia. It was something else helping our shipwrecked citizens in Dublin, Glasgow, and in other ports of refuge located on the immediate rim of the war. Ambassador Kennedy in England, on the day before the President released this information, was forced to change some plans in London.
What's this about our going to Ireland, Commander?
It's me, Captain Kurt, but Mr. Kennedy just said to meet him here at the airport.
Oh, here he comes now. I'm afraid the trip is off, gentlemen.
We're not going.
Sorry to have been so mysterious. I'd hope to land you in error tonight, but there's danger of rain. What's all the mystery, Mr. Kennedy? I need you both in Dublin to await the arrival of survivors from the Athenian. It's vital to us to have responsible officials to meet them and to take testimony.
We can take a chance on a raid.
Not only that. The Admiralty has warned us that British aircraft in Akak might fire on you at night. There are more complications. I can't send you a military aircraft because error is neutral. Isn't there any way to get through? Yes, the Admiralty has furnished a commercial aircraft. You leave in the morning. But, gentlemen, make the most of your time. It's of the essence, believe me.
Galway, Ireland, and Dublin were a madhouse. Hysterical, panic-stricken survivors were full of problems which had to be solved.
But I've lost all my clothes.
Every penny is gone. I've no money.
Oh, I've lost my passport.
My gown, I lost my gown.
I need medical attention.
I haven't slept in days.
I haven't had a day.
Oh, for some hot water.
I demand to be put in the hospital immediately.
I'm cold. Could I get a coat anywhere?
My clothes are gone.
All my luggage lost. Look at me.
Doctor, lawyer, morale builder, tourist agency, moneylender in cooperation with the Red Cross, comforter of the sick in mind and in body, international father to Americans in trouble anywhere, anytime. These are the roles played by our State Department through its foreign service. And still another part was played by a Mr. John C. Earhart, the American consul in London at the time. In a communication to the State Department, he reports,
I personally came into the picture principally after the Athenia survivors had landed in Scotland and were ready to return to the United States at government expense. Having left my office in London on a Saturday at about 2 p.m., Having put in about 16 hours a day throughout the week, I was in bed at Headley Park when an hour later...
Hello?
Hello, Earhart?
Yes.
This is Kennedy.
Oh, yes, Mr. Ambassador.
I want you to proceed to Glasgow tonight. I want you to look into the situation at Glasgow among the survivors of the Athenia. There's some kind of trouble there. I don't know if you'll be able to get through because there may be an air raid tonight, but do your best.
I got up, dressed, and hastened to London. Got transportation from the embassy and went to Charing Cross Station. I was ready to depart for Glasgow at 9 o'clock. I got on the train, got my berth, and we moved off. Trains, of course, were completely blacked out. We lumbled along, and finally I went to bed. Next morning, when I awoke, we were in the station. I said to the conductor, they must have given Glasgow a bath. It looks different.
No, sir. We're in Edinburgh. It was last night.
After some difficulty, I got to Glasgow and proceeded to meet the survivors at a local hotel. All was confusion.
Why are we being kept here?
We're not at war. Why must we be subjected to this danger?
Yes, we're American citizens.
We can't go back on that ship they've assigned us to.
No, it's out of the question.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, everybody. Wait a minute. We'll organize a committee and have a look at it. I promise you the State Department will take care of you if you'll just be patient.
I inspected the ship. While it wasn't up to the standard of a transatlantic liner, its master assured me of its seaworthiness. I spoke to him for a moment. I'm afraid when the committee arrives tomorrow, they'll give your ship a poor bill of health.
It'll go all right, Mr. Earhart. I know she looks a bit rusty, but she's a good ship.
I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's get this ship painted. Get on some more life-saving and lifeboat equipment before the committee arrives. The master accomplished a little miracle. And thanks to his quick work in improving outward appearances, the committee was satisfied. When I met the survivors again...
I can't sail again. You don't know what it is to be in an open boat, in open water. I'm just out of the hospital. I don't know which would be worse, staying here in the hospital or going out in that water again.
We turned it into an open forum. We listened to all the objections and the healthy American gripes that were forthcoming. One argument which had some definite weight I put forward.
Now, if anybody wants my job, I'll be glad to hand it over and take passage on that ship.
You've got to stay. You've got an important job to do here.
All right. All right. Those of you who can leave on the Felton should go. Because conditions, bad as they may seem to you now, may very well worsen later on. And besides, added to the inconvenience of your present situation, that's the German Air Force. You've heard them before. Well, there's the devil, and you've got the deep blue sea, officer. You'd better take the ladder. And they did.
While human problems were being solved, the role of international detective had come to an end for the State Department. On September 7th, 1939, it was possible for Sumner Wells to write,
"My dear Mr. President, with reference to our telephone conversation of this morning, I am submitting herewith memorandum which gives a summary of the official information we have received with regard to the sinking of the Athenia. The report made to this office by our officials abroad seemed to me to be sufficiently ample and positive to warrant your making reference to them at your press conference tomorrow morning. Believe me, faithfully yours, Sumner Wells."
I have a statement for you. We have reason to believe, good reason to believe, that the Athenia was torpedoed by Nazi Germany.
Thus, the official report from the Foreign Service of the State Department to the Chief Executive to the public. How many long, fearless, courageous, though unsung hours go into the making of just such a simple first statement from the President of the United States to a public that may well have faith in him and what he says.
You've been listening to Tales of the Foreign Service, a series of the NBC University of the Air written and produced in cooperation with the State Department, and based on confidential State Department files.